Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy Wallace, and I host the show. And today, I have a really cool guest on, and I'm going to ask him a lot of questions. But first, I'm going to bring him on. I'm going to let him talk a little bit about himself, and then I'll ask him questions. So, Alan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Now, Alan, by the look of the picture that I have of you, you're very young. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, okay. I am. I'm 23 years old.
So you're just a little boy here. I'm only teasing.
Well, I don't know about that.
Alan, would you tell the listeners a little bit about what you do? And we're going to talk about your book, but let's talk about you first, because you've got a little bit of stuff behind you, and then we'll talk about your book.
I'm a graduate of Yale University in political science. I've worked on a farm picking strawberries with migrant workers. I'm also the minority inspector of elections in Upper Allen Township in Pennsylvania, where I live, in Mechanicsburg, near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Okay. And how long have you been being an inspector?
I've been there almost 4 years. I'm up for re-election next year if I choose to run for re-election, and that's always exciting to be to run the elections and count the absentee ballots and make sure that everyone's vote is counted properly.
That's great, Alan. Let me ask you a couple questions, and it's up to you if you want to answer them. But I have to ask because as we get into the topic of your book, there's going to be a lot of people who want to hear what you have to say. And then we're probably going to, you know, get into some pretty controversial topics, which is fine with me because I love that. So, you know, the more you can answer for me, the better really it's going to come out, okay?
So absolutely.
The name of your book is what?
Denial and Deception, A Study of the Bush Administration's Rhetorical Case for Invading Iraq.
Okay, so what made you come up with that title?
Well, it started as my senior essay under Stanley Flink and John Lipinski, who are some of the political science faculty at Yale, and it started as a project to look at public opinion since there hadn't really been by the time when I was doing the research, which was in 2005. To 2006, there really hadn't been much in the way of study about public opinion and the war. At this point, the country was just starting, in fact, had just crossed the 50% line in terms of being opposed to the war, thinking that it was not such a good idea after all. And so I decided that this was an opportune time to do the first quantitative study of public opinion and the war. And so what I looked at were all the public opinion polls about the war in Iraq, which were collected by organizations like Gallup. And I looked at the polls over time and then correlated them with casualty counts, also economic data from the United States, and also the president's approval rating, and to see what kind of connections and what kind of conclusions we could draw from the data.
And what did you find?
The most obvious thing from the data was that the public approval of the war had precipitously dropped off, and in the summer of 2005, for the first time, a majority of Americans said that the war was not a good thing, that it was actually hurting us more than helping us. And the reasons why this was is because I think that America was waking up. We were realizing, as the data was trickling out, as the intelligence estimates that the Bush administration had ignored were finally coming to light. The national intelligence estimates from the CIA, which had dissenting opinions in the Department of Energy and the Department of State, were coming out and showing that people like Colin Powell were misled. There was a lot of pressure to think that the war would be a quote slam dunk. And what, of course, happened was that we got ourselves into a pretty big mess. And at that point in the summer of 2005, I think that Americans were starting to realize that that fact.
Okay, I have a question for you. I have not had the opportunity to read your book, so all my questions are basically going to be what I, as a U.S. citizen, am curious about, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners out there, because they're not used to me talking with somebody about, you know, like the Bush administration or anything like that. I mean, I've had some really good guests on that talk about all of the things that are hidden from the people, all of the conspiracy theories, which there are many of them, and I happen to agree with most of them. So I'm a little probably biased with my opinion here, so that's why I'm going to kind of count on yours. Do you think that the 9/11 was a set-up job?
I actually don't really think that 9/11 was a setup. What I think was a setup is that there were a number of people in the Bush administration who were just waiting for something like 9/11 to happen, and who the moment it happened, instead of thinking as Bob Woodward discussed in his first book on the war. The first thought in Paul Wolfowitz's mind and Dick Cheney might have been let's go get Saddam Hussein. It was this connection that wasn't really there. They wanted to make the leap. They wanted to get into Iraq, regardless of whether that had anything to do with the people who attacked us. And what we learned from the intelligence later, and a lot of people realized it at the time, is that there was no connection. The Bush administration had relied on false information. They had cherry-picked intelligence, and they had deliberately distorted their message to the American people. Some might even say that they lied on a number of occasions. And I went through Bush's speeches, in fact, and found that he had made a number of false and misleading statements, and his top lieutenants as well, over the course of the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, and then during that period that ended in mission accomplished. And so I think that what the American people realized eventually is that regardless of the reasons behind 9/11, which I think that we were right to go into Afghanistan, but we were clearly wrong to go into Iraq. And that's where the Bush administration just threw away their constitutional prerogatives and just did what they had set out to do, which was to attack the people who were not responsible for 9/11.
Do you think that President Bush's, one of his reasons for trying to bring down Hussein is because his dad had attempted it and it was not successful?
A lot of people say that. And there is some reason to believe that there may have been some psychological things going on there. There may have been some residue that Bush really wanted to get back at Saddam Hussein for his dad, for supposedly trying to assassinate his dad, these sorts of things, never mind the fact that we had tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein on a number of occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time that, and in fact in the late 90s, President H.W. Bush had specifically said that we shouldn't go into Iraq. He and Brent Scowcroft had written about how going into Iraq would lead us into a quagmire, that it would lead us into a situation that would spiral out of control, where there are all these different factions coming together, and that's what we're dealing with now, and that's why we're finding it so hard to get out of Iraq, because we've exacerbated the situation, and then as soon as we went into Iraq, Al-Qaeda followed us, so they followed our troops into Iraq, and at that point, now we have Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and that is a significant problem. So now there really are the terrorists who attacked us on 9/11 or people who are in close ties in Iraq. And that's an extremely difficult situation to get out of.
Do you think that there is going to be a good way to get out of Iraq?
Well, it's one of those situations where there are no good options. I personally believe that we have to get out of Iraq. I have two cousins who have served in Iraq. One of them was not allowed to leave because of the stop-loss policy. He had served his 7 years, his contract was up, and they would not let him out. And we received a fairly unhappy and angry Christmas letter from his family that year. And that's pretty unfortunate when the soldiers who we're sending to Iraq are there against their will. And that's a sign that we really shouldn't be there. If our own troops do not support the war, then we really shouldn't be there. And so I think what we need to do at this point is to really phase out. We need to start withdrawing the troops from Iraq. We should stay, you know, in the area. We should finish the job in Afghanistan, first of all. And that's actually, I think, one of the solutions to the problem, is that if we can finish the job in Afghanistan that we should have finished a couple years ago, instead we withdrew to Iraq, we moved our troops there. If we can finish the job in Afghanistan, our troop levels can go up again. Right now we're strained to the breaking point. We're having to rely on reserves. We're having to rely on National Guard troops. Everyone now who joins the military pretty much is warned, or at least has an idea that they have a pretty good likelihood of being sent to Iraq. And that's pretty scary. And so it's one of those situations where, at this point, what good are our troops doing? To me, all they're doing is getting killed. And that is really sad.
I agree with that.
So if we can get out of Iraq, we're going to save American lives.
I totally agree with that statement.
And so it's a civil war over there at this point. What good are we doing by staying there? I think is the question that America needs to ask. I think that's the question that that the presidential candidates need to really address. Right now they've been the leading candidates have been somewhat flaky on the question, with the exception of Senator McCain, who has said that he wants us to be in Iraq for the long, for who knows how long. And I hope that there is some support for us to get out.
I agree. I heard, maybe I shouldn't say it, but I'm going to say it anyway. There was a person who made a statement to me last Thursday that there was a meeting in Florida Friday, Saturday, and maybe Sunday of all the world leaders who were coming together to decide what they were going to do about the war. Now, I don't know who started it. I don't know if the statement is true or anything else. But if this statement is true, I find it ironic that they're all meeting down in Florida to figure out what they're going to do with the war and not tell any of the U.S. citizens that that's what's going on.
Absolutely. One of the reasons why we've had all the problems with Iraq in the first place, and that's something that I talk about in my book, Denial and Deception, and in the title, in fact, is that there was so much that the Bush administration hid from the American people or distorted to the point where we didn't know the facts. And that's really what the thing that has the secrecy within the administration that really turned the war in Iraq into such a tragedy. And I hope that our new leaders, the presidential candidates and the world leaders from other countries, won't follow that example. We'll try a new model. And instead of being secretive, instead of trying to cherry-pick the information and frame it the best way that's possible, I hope that they'll just go to the people. And we need to really, as a country, the American citizens should be the ones deciding whether to stay in Iraq. And so it's one of those situations where, in fact, if the as shown by the gains that that the Democrats made for Congress in 2006, the tremendous gains, winning both houses of Congress, if that had been a presidential year, maybe President Bush would have been he would have been thrown out if we had had a different system. If we had had the at a parliamentary system, for instance, he would have been out at that point. Just like there was so much pressure on other leaders in other countries, since they have since a lot of European countries have the parliamentary system, they're under much more pressure to maintain support from their parliaments or the analogous to Congress. And so, in that sense, it's unfortunate that we have a lame duck in office, who at this point really doesn't care. Bush hasn't cared, or seemingly cared, about the will of the American people for a long time, and has made statements saying that he doesn't care about polls. He doesn't care about the fact that the majority of Americans don't think we should be in Iraq anymore. That's the sort of mentality that we really need to change.
Oh, totally. The Patriot Act. Do you understand it?
It's one of those acts. I have read the Patriot Act. I'm currently studying law at William & Mary, and the Patriot Act is an incredibly long and convoluted piece of legislation that was passed in the dead of night, where many of the members of Congress did not even read it before they voted for it. And it's an act that is pretty scary, at least from what I've seen of it. The sneak and peek, for instance, is a provision where the police can go into your home and download files from your computer and then leave, all without a real warrant, and then leave and have these files downloaded and view them without ever telling you. And that's the sort of thing that is in the Patriot Act. This is something. The Patriot Act is completely in violation of our civil liberties. We need to really be concerned about the Patriot Act and other legislation. The legislation that would give immunity to the telecoms for their violations of the foreign of FISA. These are issues that we need to think critically about. We should keep an eye and not give immunity to people who break the law. And in the case of the Patriot Act, a lot of the provisions, have these sunset provisions where they can expire and then Congress will just keep renewing them. We need to make sure and tell our members of Congress that they should not renew any part of the Patriot Act, especially not something like the provision that would allow the administration or law enforcement to find out what kind of books you're taking out of the library. That part of it, for instance, the librarians of the United Association came out against that portion of the legislation. And so there are so many different things in the Patriot Act to be concerned about. It's really hard to get a grasp on the whole thing.
Do you think that we still have our constitutional rights?
We live in a pretty dangerous time in America, and there over the last 8 years, we've seen a lot of our rights disappear. There have been challenges to those to a lot of those instances. There have been legal challenges to the Patriot Act. There have been legal challenges to arrests without warrants. There have been legal challenges to certain security measures that go too far, to terrorist watch lists that sweep up innocent American citizens. These are things that we really do need to be concerned about, and it's worrisome that we now have a whole host of judges in place who conceivably could uphold these, because they were appointed by President Bush and the Republican Congress. And in fact, a lot of the Democrats support these measures. So it's not just the Republicans. It's not a one-party thing. The Patriot Act got passed with a lot of support. Senator Clinton voted for the war. Senator Obama might have voted for the war if he were in the Senate at the time, but he didn't have the opportunity to do that. Senator Edwards voted for the war later, of course, came out pretty heavily against it not long after. It's one of those situations where it's easy to see how we got blindsided and how a lot of people in the highest reaches of power could be misled by the administration. And I'm worried that we might get misled again. I was a little bit worried that that we might try to do a unilateral attack on Iran, which certainly we really don't like the people in power. These are scary regimes. However, they're not necessarily where we should be committing American troops and putting our sons, our daughters, our cousins in harm's way.
Again, I agree totally with that. In your book, I repeat, I did not get the chance to read your book, but mm-hmm. in your book, do you talk about the oil and how that plays a part in what our government has done?
I didn't talk much about oil since there, at least at that point in time, there wasn't much data on it. I looked more at casualty counts and correlated that and found that the largest correlation between the approval rating, the approval of the war and where this was going was with cumulative casualty counts. And so at a certain point, it was sort of like a tipping point that when the numbers of Americans who were dying over in Iraq and who had died previously or who were getting injured, which we have record numbers of injured because the technology is such that it saves American lives, however, it doesn't save them from getting wounded, that there was a big correlation there. Going back to your question, however, on the oil, there certainly is a good argument to be made that this is a war for oil. Although, obviously, that's not reflected in our gas prices, which are at all-time highs in many places. It's certainly well over $3 a gallon in Virginia, and in the D.C. metropolitan area, it can be significantly more than that, and in other big cities around the country. And so it's one of those things where you do have to wonder, though, with Vice President Dick Cheney having been CEO of Halliburton, which has many of these no-bid contracts for oil in Iraq, could that have been a reason we went in? I think it's likely. I think there's a lot of evidence to show that they had a lot to gain by going into Iraq, a lot to gain personally through getting oil out of Iraq. And the sad thing, though, is that the oil production has not been up to par, and that the oil production hasn't helped the Iraqi people very much. There were overestimates of how much oil and how fast they could get the oil out. A lot of the money is going to companies like Halliburton. Even so, it's not doing very much for Iraqis. There have been reports recently in the New York Times and the Washington Post about how they're just not keeping up with the schedule, or the original estimates were clearly exaggerated, similar to the estimates that we would be greeted with flowers when we arrived. That didn't happen, and the estimates regarding oil, a lot of the estimates regarding when we could get Iraq up and running with sanitation, with electricity, with all these other things that went out when our military went in, that all of this has been exaggerated.
So do you think that our government likes the fact of trying to create the fear tactic for the United States citizens so that they have to continue to live in fear due to the thing of terrorists here, there's going to be a terrorist attack there, we know it, we stopped it. Do you think that's also a ploy of our government to keep us in fear?
Absolutely. I actually interned, was the first intern with the Pennsylvania Office of Homeland Security when that got set up in the first summer. In 2003, I was an intern there. And, you know, I would see the emails from the FBI on how to spot a terrorist. And the advice that the FBI had to the state offices of Homeland Security was, look for packages, look for strollers, look for people with duffel bags. The FBI didn't have a clue how to spot a terrorist. Look for people with turbans. I mean, this was really what I was seeing on the messages, on the letters that would come down from the FBI about Homeland Security, which is, you know, unbelievable. This is really it just showed in 2003 how the government was trying to get us to live in fear, and that's what I think the whole point of that color coded alert system that made Tom Ridge so famous was the code yellow and orange and red and never bringing it back to green. Was certainly one of those areas where you could not only make people live in fear, but you could also increase the pressure on politicians and legislatures to spend a whole lot of money on security. And so there have been a lot of companies that have gotten rich off of the war in Iraq and the general mentality of fear that you get that the Patriot Act plays into. So there have been recent exposés on Blackwater overseas, which does private contracting. And Blackwater was responsible for some murders, it's likely. And this is a situation where, you know, they're making a lot of money. Halliburton has made a lot of money on this, and a whole lot of other security firms are getting rich on this culture of fear. And so what we need to think about is, how do we cut through that? And I actually have hope for the United States. I think that what I found with when I was researching for my book is that the American people had just gradually started to wake up. The fear tactics of the Bush administration were short term, not long term. They only lasted for a couple years. They had very short term power over us. The hard part is really that we really do have to go back and fix all of the terrible decisions that we made before that.
Do you think that there will be some more terrorist acts here in the United States?
It could happen. There certainly are. We certainly do have a lot of enemies, and the war in Iraq has certainly made a lot more enemies overseas, and that's not just al-Qaeda. We've made enemies through the war in Iraq in a host of countries, and that's even evidenced by the fact that most of our allies over there pulled out. We have reports that, you know, every day or every week, Some ally is expressing hesitation over whether they should still be there, and so it's just it's a coalition of the dwindling is really what our war effort is there in Iraq, and so it's a sense that there could be another terrorist attack, and would we be prepared? I'm not even convinced that we would. When I was at the Pennsylvania Office of Homeland Security, I found it shocking that we didn't have a clue what we were doing. There was no manual. Nobody could, you know, if we're looking for terrorists by looking at duffel bags and strollers and turbans, we really don't have an understanding of other cultures and of the motivations why people would hate America or why they would want to attack us. And that's something that I hope we look more closely at is the at different cultures, at people at people who are suicide bombers, why would they do that? And if we can understand their motivations, if we can get inside that, then we will be better able to protect it. And frankly, at this point, the Bush administration has proven completely incompetent in that area. We had Michael Brown, the Brownie, heck of a job after Katrina, in charge of Homeland Security, and he proved that the Bush administration couldn't even handle responding to Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. How in the world are we going to prevent another terrorist attack? And that's, I think, something that we should really worry about.
Do you think some of the other countries might have nuclear weapons at this stage?
Absolutely. We know that. We know that India and Pakistan have nuclear weapons. I think that we should be worried about countries that we have given weapons to using them. I think that what we need to remember that we funded and we gave weapons to Osama bin Laden. We funded and we gave weapons to Saddam Hussein. All of these dictators that are now our enemies were allies of us at some point in the 80s. And so we've actually created a lot of the regimes in the Middle East that we hate now. We created them at the beginning, or at least helped them to build up. And so we need to worry about that. If Osama bin Laden can turn on the United States like that, then why couldn't Musharraf in Pakistan? What does he have holding him back? Something like that. I would be worried about Pakistan. I think that we need to worry about that. I think we should think about Iran, although I doubt that they actually have nuclear weapons yet. I think that they're actively trying to get them. And that's a process that we can deal with, but that's mostly through diplomacy. There's not really a way at this point for us to prevent nuclear weapons from spreading, since we've destroyed many of our diplomatic relationships over the last 8 years.
Do you know why Osama bin Laden is so angry at our country? Because at one time, we were all friends.
Oh, Osama bin Laden was certainly one of our guys. You're absolutely right. We gave him money, we gave him weapons, and as long as they were fighting the Soviets, as long as they were fighting someone else, then we would keep on providing them with aid. And I think that part of it is that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States became the big superpower, the only one. And so, of course, that left us open to being being the one to attack. Of course, people are going to always pick on the big guy since we're a walking target, and we have so much money, we have so much influence around the world, and we exert it we throw our weight around in ways that offends people. Certainly, the Bush administration does not make friends when they unilaterally bomb another country, or when they insult the United Nations and refuse to join the International Criminal Court and other international bodies. These are things that are not not ingratiating us with the rest of the world, and so that's something that we should really work on.
Do you think our country really wants to catch Osama bin Laden?
I don't think that the Bush administration is going to. I don't think that they're going to catch Osama bin Laden. If they could have caught him, It would have been in the mountains of Tora Bora early on when we were first going into Afghanistan. We had a prime opportunity. The intelligence was there. We had troops not far. And the problem was that we needed to send a lot more soldiers in at that point to make a big effort to catch them, and we let that opportunity slip away. And that I think shows something about the Bush administration, is that it's partly incompetence and partly this arrogance that they might not have cared enough to catch Osama bin Laden, since if we did that, then who would be the enemy? Who would President Bush have put? Have showed in his commercial to try to scare people not to vote for John Kerry. It was a picture of Osama bin Laden, and all the memories of 9/11. To try to bring all that back again and again and again, that we've seen that they may not even care about catching the bad guys.
Yeah, I saw a video one time through the entire 9/11 escapades. Okay. One time, and it after that, it totally disappeared. And what this video showed was Osama bin Laden meeting with somebody else. And his statement, and this was given by somebody that was not working for the Bush administration, but as just an interpreter. His comment was, "We were told the attack was going to be on Thursday."
Mm-hmm.
It was showed one time. One time only, and it totally disappeared.
Wow.
Now, to me, that says that maybe Osama trained the people, but it does not sound like he ordered it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to know exactly, you know, whether he ordered it. 19 out of the 21 hijackers were Saudi, and we had very close ties, or at least the Bushes personally had very close ties, and still do, to the Saudi royal government. They made arrangements so that folks around Osama bin Laden, that family members could get out of the United States. They could they would be away from the United States in the wake of 9/11. And this is, you know, essentially that might be considered harboring the enemy. These are sorts of things that do not really reflect well on any effort to catch Osama bin Laden. And in fact, there was the presidential briefing paper that Bush had received on, I believe it was, in mid-August, had received a briefing paper that said Al-Qaeda is going or wants to hijack airplanes and hit major United States targets. And then lower down, they thought, well, what would be a target? New York City, skyscrapers in these major cities. And so the information largely was there. It was in August. Bush was at the ranch. Was he paying attention? Probably not. Would he have? He probably didn't care all that much at that point. And that's something that is reflected by the fact that what's the first thing that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld thought about when the attack happened? Was it, we're going to go find Osama bin Laden? Well, that was one of the things. But immediately after that, the next thought on September 11th, the day of, was, let's go get Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Bush administration, or maybe all of them, are trying to eliminate the middle class families, or the middle class, whatever you want to call it?
Well, the way that they've done their tax cuts have all been aimed at the rich, and the middle class has largely been ignored. The middle class has received very little help, and in fact has often been penalized in the tax system. The Bush tax cuts have largely gone just to the top 2%, or even the top 1% of the population. I think many people still remember when John Kerry would say, why are 50% of the cuts going to 2% of the population? And that's something that rings true today, that Senator Edwards went a long way in his presidential campaign with the Two Americas theme, where the middle class has been marginalized to the point where we're no longer really in the middle. We're now falling behind. Wages are going down relative to our buying power. And in some places, they actually are going down. Certainly salaries and wages are not keeping up with inflation. They're not keeping up with rising gas prices. Gas prices are now taking a huge chunk of my money and of many Americans' money as we try to go to work to earn that. And that's something that we really should pay more attention to. That if we've had to be preoccupied with Iraq over the last 8 years, and the Bush administration has made that foreign policy element its centerpiece, and at the same time has done very little on the domestic front. And so we've allowed healthcare premiums to go up. Health insurance is at a breaking point, at a crisis, where the insurance companies continue to get rich. And yet many Americans who have regular jobs are having to get second jobs or going without health insurance. And that's something else that we probably should pay more attention to. Why is it that it took a decade for the minimum wage to go up a dollar? Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where, where several of the jobs that I've worked in the last few years were below what the new minimum wage is going to be. At one point I worked at McDonald's, and 1 in 8 Americans have worked at McDonald's, so it's not something that only poor people do, to work in fast food restaurants and other low wage jobs, where I was comparing the wage of McDonald's to Wendy's because one of them paid minimum wage and one paid about 20 cents more.
Yeah, which is, again, important. Again, you're very young, so and you have a great deal of knowledge, so I'm not picking on you. What do you think that the people that are your age, okay, are going to do as this country continues to decline, not only with the value of the dollar, but just decline in general? What do you think the people in your age bracket should be doing even now to help stop it, or should they just allow it and then plan on rebuilding it?
It's really hard to know. And what's somewhat discouraging to me is how a lot of people my age are not thinking about it. They're not involved politically, or they are looking only at their interests, where they may be very privileged. And what we really do need to be thinking about is that how are we going to deal with an economy that looks bleak, and gas prices that probably won't ever go down again. These are issues that we really do need to deal with. It's rather depressing to think that if gas prices just keep going up and up, eventually we won't be able to afford to drive, or at least not to the level that we do now. And so something, there are solutions, though. We should be thinking about public transportation. We need to be thinking about really stepping up and putting in some sort of perhaps universal health insurance. Should be a national single payer system is something that, you know, is long overdue politically. But that's only going to happen if people my age register to vote, if they go out and write letters to their congressman, if they make the effort to stay, to be involved, and to think of the interests of our entire generation. So it's one of those times in, I guess, our nation's history where maybe we should be asking our grandparents how they got through the Great Depression. We should be asking our parents how they got through the gas crises of the 70s. This is something where I think we can learn from history if we make an effort to.
Or it's going to keep repeating, and that depression will be here again. I mean, right now, if you look at everything, people are talking about recession, and they're trying not to mention the word depression. But we're really headed in a very downward spiral as to making sure that it's all going to repeat itself again. And if it doesn't change, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to have to figure out how to survive, because it's not going to be easy. It's not probably ever going to be easy again until people, doesn't matter what age, start to pay attention to everything that is being taken away from us and everything that's being told to us that is a bunch of lies. And
that's right.
Us sitting here like lambs being led to a slaughterhouse because we are too afraid to take responsibility, to get off of our lazy butts and say, hey, I don't like what's going on, so let's do something about it.
That's right. And I think that people my age need to be looking at the whole situation. They need to be looking at the war in Iraq and saying, if this is a war for oil, then why are our gas prices still going up? And why are ExxonMobil and the other gas companies making record profits?
But our government makes money with them.
Absolutely. And why is Halliburton getting billion-dollar no-bid contracts in Iraq? Why do they continue to make a killing, to use a really bad term, in Iraq? This is something that they are literally winning treasure. They're literally getting rich off of our generation dying. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we should really be trying to connect the dots. And that goes back to why I wrote my book, which is that the American public had been misled and had been deceived, and at the same time was also partially responsible for letting Bush get away with it, for being misled. It does take two. It takes the person doing the deceiving, and it takes the person deceived. And so part of that responsibility does have to go back for the war in Iraq to the senators and the members of Congress who voted for the war. And we need to hold them accountable. We need to make sure that they are responsible for their bad decisions or for going along with these lies and with the deception.
And I agree with all that. Now, give everybody the name of your book again and where they can get it.
The name of the book again is Denial and Deception, A Study of the Bush Administration's Rhetorical Case for Invading Iraq. The easiest place to get it is to go online to Amazon.com or to Barnes & Noble, or you can actually go into any Barnes & Noble request it. If that particular store does not carry it, and so that's the best place. It's published by Universal Publishers as well, so that is another option to get it. I've actually done some book signings at Barnes & Noble bookstores, and so they've been very helpful and supportive.
Which is good. Do you have like a website or any way that the listeners might be able to get a hold of you?
Sure. If anyone wants to reach me, they can go online to www.alankennedy-schaefer.com, and then there's a form on there that my email address is contact@kennedy-schaefer.com.
Okay, now Schaefer is S-H-A-F-F-E-R.
Right, it's all one thing, so it's Alankennedy-Schaefer.
Okay, and that's it, .com.
.com.
Okay. I have a couple other questions. Well, I wrote a book, too, and it's an e-book that I am still putting together, and it's called The What Do You Think Workbook. And what it is all questions, jokes, and quotes about all facets of our life, government, religion, media, pharmaceutical companies, oil companies, veterans, all of it. And it really is a think book. You know, it's like questions like I said, you know, do you think we're being led like lambs to a slaughterhouse? That's one of the questions in there. So there's many, many questions in there that people really need to try to figure out what the answers are. You know, reading your book, I'm sure, would help people understand a lot of what has gone on. Because with the media, we're only told exactly what they allow us to be told. You know, there's not a lot of truth in a lot of it, and there's a lot of left-out stuff that could be more truthful. So people really need to start looking at things, you know, taking a look at your book, actually reading, you know, some information about what's really going on rather than keep their head hidden in the sand. Because it's the ones that keep their head hidden in the sand that sit around later and complain about, well, shouldn't it be like this, it shouldn't be like that, but they've done nothing to try to change it.
Absolutely. And really, that's what it comes down to, is that that we do need to ask the questions. We do need to be alert and to watch out when we might be misled, or when there might be an agenda that is being forced on the American people that really is not in our best interest. And so we need to really ask those questions, and that's terrific.
Give out the name of your book one more time and quickly how to get it, because we're almost out of time.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, the name of the book again is Denial and Deception, A Study of the Bush Administration's Rhetorical Case for Invading Iraq. And this is the first quantitative study of the Iraq War, particularly with public opinion and the Bush administration. And it's available at BarnesandNoble.com or in any Barnes & Noble bookstore. Can go up and request it there, or at Amazon.com, and just search for Denial and Deception.
And give out your information if they want to contact you.
And again, to contact me, it's Alan Kennedy Schaefer. And it's alankennedy-schaefer.com. And my email address is contact@alankennedy-schaefer.com. And thanks so much for having me on the show.
Oh, it's been really my pleasure. I really enjoy talking with people like you who are not afraid to say what they're seeing and what's really going on. You know, and hopefully this will help a lot of people sit up and take notes about all the things that are passing them by each second of the day that they think somebody else is going to handle, when in reality, they're not. It has to come from every single United States citizen here before we lose everything that we have, and that's kind of what we're headed for, unfortunately. So it's been my pleasure actually interviewing you. I wish you the best of luck, Alan, with other books. I'm sure you're going to write more. And let me know if you do, because we'll bring you back on for another show, and we'll ask you some more questions and get your opinions. But please, everybody, you really need to take a look at his book and kind of then make up your own choice, but at least you'll have a choice at that time. So, again, Alan, thank you very much for being on this show. And I would like to thank you, all of the listeners. I hope you've enjoyed today's show. And if you have questions and like to speak with Alan, please feel free to get a hold of him. And until next week, may God bless all of you. Have a great week. Do some thinking about this, and take care. Bye now.